Welcome back from the Pesach break. Those who may be feeling the effects of the Pesach break, we are in Sefer Shmuel. Let's start with that. Perek Yetet, chapter 19. So we're somewhat oriented, and it's been a couple of weeks. So just to review. Remember that chapter 16 was when Shmuel anointed David, right? And then Shaul is affected by this ruach ra'ah, this, whatever we call it, harmful spirit. But really, as we explained, the feeling that Hashem has abandoned him, and David goes to play music for him. Then in Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, David beat Goliath. He killed Goliath. And we have a whole discussion, which events happened first, which events happened second, not going back through that. And then, in Perek Yudchet, in chapter 18, so we saw a lot of things happen, but in particular, hang on one second, I just realized I'm on the wrong page. There we go. That in chapter 18, we found that Shaul's condition is worsening. He hears the women praising David, or it sounds like they're praising David, whether that's their intention or not, and that arouses his jealousy and his ruach ra'ah. He sees David's success. He tries to marry off his older daughter, Merav, to David, does not succeed in that. David refuses. And then he ends up marrying off his daughter, Michal, to David. But overall, things are indeed getting worse for Shaul, and that was the theme of that chapter. And that brought us to Perek Yetet, to chapter 19. And chapter 19, really, the more I see of it, and the more work I do in trying to understand it, is fundamentally, really, about what seems to be the betrayal of Shaul. That's really what it looks like, is the betrayal of Shaul. In the sense that we find three people who are close to Shaul who are faced with choosing sides between Shaul and David, right? The first one was Yehonatan. When Shaul tells Yehonatan and his servants of a plan to kill David, and Yehonatan warns David to hide and then tries to convince Shaul not to carry it out. Then we're going to get Michal coming up in the part that I want to do today, as she is forced to make a decision between supporting her father and supporting David. And then finally, at the end of the parak, it's going to be Shmuel's turn to make this decision about, once again, Shaul or David. So that's really what it is. It's the betrayal of Shaul, although, worth noting, that it's not necessarily going to be the betrayal that it looks like. And you'll see, as we go through it. So, against all of that as backdrop, if you take a look on the sheet that I sent out, everyone has it, right? So, I noted at the top just three bullet points that from the earlier parts of the parak, the earlier parts of the chapter. Number one, Shaul, as we said, openly calls for the death of David, whether he's telling his servants to carry it out or whether he's just saying, I want this to happen. Yehonatan warns David about it. Yehonatan goes to Shaul and tries to calm him down. He seems to be successful. Remember we said either that he says to Shaul, you know, David has done good things for you, or he plays up the fact that God is on David's side. The tshua gedola that we talked about, the great salvation was created via David, and just like that work to save Yehonatan in the in an earlier story after he ate, violating the oath that Shaul had taken, so too now he uses that to save David. Yehonatan says to David, don't worry about it, my father said he's not going to hurt you, you're now safe. And then the last thing that we saw in chapter 19 was when David found out that promises are not necessarily worth, a verbal promise is not worth the paper it's written on. So the oath that Shaul had taken, saying that, oh no, I would never hurt him, he's going to be fine, doesn't last all that long, because in chapter 19, sentence 9, Vatehi Ruach Hashem Ra'ah El Shaul, the Ruach Ra'ah revisits Shaul, Vahu Beveso Yoshev. He's sitting in his house, Vachaniso Biyado, he has that spear in his hand, V'David Nagein Biyad, and David is, again, playing for Shaul, and Shaul tries to hit David with the spear, and this time, unlike what we've seen previously, David is aware of it. David sees it. And at that point, he says, I gotta get out of here, and he flees. So whatever Yehonatan thinks is going on, David knows what's going on. He knows that he is not safe with Shaul. Clear? Okay? Good. We got in a little bit of a summary. And now we're ready to proceed with Michal. So we are up to Perek Yotet Pasuk Yud Aleph, chapter 19, sentence 11. So what I'd like to do is first just read through the story, and then we're going to take it apart bit by bit. So it's going to be sentences 11 to 17, and this is the night after David fled. David was in the palace, he was attacked, he fled. This happens that night. So here we go. Vayishlach Shaul Malachim. Sorry?
Sorry, can I just say, were they already married?
Yes, they are.
Oh, okay.
Vayishlach Shaul Malachim El Beis David L'Shomro V'Lahamiso Baboker. So I'm going to read this sentence one way right now and translate it one way right now, but we're going to have to come back to the sentence. Shaul sent agents to the house of David to watch him and V'Lahamiso Baboker to kill him in the morning. Vatagei David Michal Ishto Lemor Im Ein Chamim Aleides Nafshecha David Michal Ishto Lemor Im Ein Chamim Aleides Nafshecha Halayla Machar Ata Mumas. Michal says to David, "You got to get out of here tonight, because otherwise you're dead tomorrow." So Michal knows. Yehonatan may not know what Shaul is planning, but Michal sure knows. Vatorid Michal es David be'arach halon. Michal lowers David from the window. Vayelech vayivrach vayimaleit. He goes, he flees, he escapes. Vatikach Michal es haterafim. Vatasim el hamita. Michal took something called the terafim. Boy, that's a word we know. We're going to have to spend some time on that one. And she puts them in the bed. Ve'ez kivir ha'izim sama mira'ashosav. And she puts something involving a goat, again, we have to talk about what this is, at the head of the bed, v'techas ba'baged, and she covers it up with a garment. She wants to do, right, that which you've seen in any number of movies and television shows when someone's getting out of jail, right? They, let's put the mannequin in the bed, and that way nobody's gonna know the difference. Except this time it worked. I guess because this is the first time someone tried it. Fine. Vayishlach Shaul Malachim Lakachas es David. Vatomer Cholehu. So Shaul sends agents to go get David, and she says, oh, I'm sorry, he's not feeling well. Vayishlach Shaul es Ham, by the way, just, I'll mention it now, even though it's, you know, something we have to come back to, but come on, how many times are we gonna see, someone's daughter put Trafim in a bed and then lie to her father about it? This is not the first time this movie has run either. Vayishlach Shaul es hamalachim leros es David lemor halu oso bamita elai lahamiso. So Shaul sends the agents to see David. Maybe I can't take him yet. I want to see what the deal is here. Saying, bring him up to me in the bed if need be to kill him. So it's to see and to take, I guess. Vayavoa malachim, so the malachim, these agents show up, the hinei hatrafim el hamita, uchvir ha'izim ra'ashosav, lo and behold, it's trafim and this goat thing, whatever that is. Vayomer Shaul el Michal, lama kacha rimisani? Hey, you tricked me. Vatishalachi es oivi vayimaleit. Shaul says to Michal, you tricked me, and you sent away my enemy so that he could escape? Yes, your husband, my enemy. Vatomer Michal el Shaul. Michal says to Shaul, Hu amar elai shalcheni lama amisech. She says, what was I supposed to do? He said to me, I'm going to kill you if you don't send me away. So, I didn't have a choice. I was acting under threat. That's what she says, and that completes the story. So obviously there is a lot that we need to understand about this story. This is not a this is not straightforward at all. So let's take it bit by bit. First, go back to Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11, right? Notice right there that Shaul sends Malachim to the house of David to watch him, and the goal is to kill him in the morning. This is something that we also saw back in sentence 2. When Yonatan warns David that his father wants to kill him, and he says, wait until morning. There's a sense of, they're not attacking until morning. No one does these attacks during the night in someone's house. We talked about it from Shimshon. Also, some suggest that the reason why he wants to wait until morning is to spare Michal the trauma. Don't do anything in the house. This way we'll do it, we'll take care of it in the morning. However, the commentators on this are very clear to say, Shaul does not actually tell this group of agents to execute David. Even though a quick read of the sentence sounds like that, right? If you read the sentence quickly, it says, where was it? Hang on. Shaul sent Malachim to the house of David, Lishomro v'lahamiso baboker, right? To watch him and kill him in the morning is the way I would have read it. However, that's not actually the way to read it. The simple read is indeed that. And not only is that the simple read, but take a look, please, in Tehillim chapter 59. I gave you the reference on the source sheet. So open a Tanakh. Tehillim Nun Tet. The opening sentence. Okay, you see that? So this poem, which I want to come back to at the end of this passage, maybe this week, maybe next week, but this poem is framed as a poem which David composes, Bishloach Shaul Vayishmeru as Habayis Lahamiso, when Shaul sent and they guarded the house to kill him. Right? The same wording almost as we saw in our sentence. This is part of a series of chapters in Tehillim that are presented as being autobiographical, relate to David's being rescued from particular events. So, given that the sentence in Tehillim sounds like they want to kill him, like that's their mission, and given that our sentence here, read quickly, sounds like in 1911, sounds like they want that the mission is in fact for them to kill him, how do we know that it's not correct? How do we know that this group of Malachim was not sent to kill David from the story itself?
I think because of the second group of Malachim, he doesn't tell them to bring him.
Right.
Not to kill him.
Right. The simple answer is because in sentence 14, Shaul is going to send Malachim to take David. So this group wasn't to kill him. If this group was to kill him, then what happened? Why did you end up sending a second group of Malachim? There's no reason for that. So it's clear these are not meant to kill him. Yes, Sandy.
If I missed it, but why would you wait? If you really want to kill somebody, you're not going to wait until the morning.
Right.
Unless that's just honor to not do something in the cloak of darkness. And so it makes me think that he wants to bring him back to the palace to make an example of him in some way, but...
Right. So what we've suggested, linking it back to Yehonatan's confidence in the beginning of the chapter, we've suggested that maybe the answer is that it's not safe to attack someone in their home at night. You can't see, you know, that it's their territory. And the other possibility that we floated is that it's to protect Michal. That's why he doesn't want to do it at night. But the fact that he's going to send a second group saying bring him to the palace shows you the first group is not out to kill him. And in fact, Ralbag says it. Take a look, please, at source number 2 on the sheet. Ralbag says, Lishomro, to guard him or to watch him, Shelo yetzei misham, so that he doesn't leave, Kidei sheyuchlu lahavi osoe lav baboker lahamisala yedei achad me'avadav, Ba'ofen sheyis ames Shaul shekvar meis David. The idea is, bring him in the morning, so that Shaul will be able to have somebody kill him, and that way he'll know for sure that David is dead. He wants to do it at the palace, he wants to see it, he wants to know it is done. And that's why he didn't tell them to kill David. Because he's worried that, and this is a third explanation now, Sandy, for why not to attack right away. He's worried that in the event that he sends the agents and they try to kill him, David is going to come up with some way to get around it. Not to mention, he wants to do it in secret. So there is also the possibility that he really doesn't want the publicity of doing this at David's house. That's another explanation for why. But it seems fairly clear. I would also note that it has to be that he doesn't order them to kill David. Because if he ordered them to kill David, do you know who would know about it? Besides, obviously, Michal knows about it. Michal knows what's
Yonatan.
Up. Yonatan, exactly. Jump ahead for a second to chapter 20, the beginning of chapter 20. In the beginning of chapter 20, David is going to complain to Yonatan and saying, "What have I done wrong that your father wants to kill me?" And Yehonatan very innocently says, "God forbid, no way. My father would never do a thing like that. He would have told me if he was going to do something like that." Yehonatan in chapter 20 is still living in denial. If Shaul had actually issued a public order of catch him and kill him, Yehonatan would not be able to deny that Shaul wants David dead. That point is made by Rabbi Yosef Didi in an article that I'm going to be talking about later on. So, in that case, how do we read chapter 19, sentence 11? Right? Because that sentence said, he sent men to guard him and kill him in the morning. So I think what you have to do is read it as, and tell me if your translations go along these lines, Shaul sent Malachim to the house of David to guard him, and there's a second mission here, which is the ultimate goal of to kill him in the morning, in order to be able to kill him in the morning. Those of you who have translations, is that how they do it?
They Susan's just say not and. In this. They say and. It still seems like it's what we originally thought.
Yeah, it just can't be, though. It doesn't make any sense.
No. I agree. I think that you're adding in order to.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Okay. Leona.
I think there's something else here that's a little bit interesting. My question was always, why would he tell Michal what he's planning to do and not tell Yonatan?
Yes.
And my feeling is, I'll just say my feeling, I'm probably wrong, that we had learned all the way through how much everybody in the palace loved David. For Shaul to tell his workers, you know, his employees, that he wants them to kill David, the chances are that they might not be so loyal because there would be a real dilemma for them not to obey the king, but yet to kill somebody that they have really great admiration for. So he second time when he realizes, I don't know if he realizes that Michal knows, but that's the only way she could have known. He wouldn't tell his daughter and not tell Yonatan,
so,
who he knows is very close. Okay, it might be as his wife, but he knows Yonatan loves David also. Why wouldn't he tell him and just Michal, who loves her husband?
Right.
So it doesn't make sense to me.
So the Yonatan part, I think I can grasp. The not telling Yonatan part, I can grasp. Meaning, we already saw in the beginning of the chapter that Shaul assumed Yonatan was on his side. Right? He gave orders saying, I'm going to want David dead. But then he found out when Yehonatan objected that Yehonatan is not really on board with it. So I think at this point he's hiding it from him. But with Michal, to come back to your original question, how is it that Michal knows? I think he believes that Michal is on his side. I think he thinks Michal is in his corner, and I think he has told her. Even though she's married to David, in Shaul's mind, everybody is going to be on his side, and certainly his family is going to be on his side. He can't expect that they're going to take David over him. I think that's really what this is about, and I think he told Michal, because otherwise, you're right, I have no understanding of why she knows. Eti, and then Janine.
My question is, does it say anywhere that he told Michal, or are we assuming?
Well, how else does she know?
I'm assuming that because she loves David, she's his wife, she may have seen those malachim outside, and she has intuition that he's in trouble.
So, you could say that. It's just a little bit of a leap. Hi, my father told me to marry you, right? I see some of his men outside. I think he might want to kill you. Not I think I might. If you wait till morning, you're dead. I mean, yes, you could say it's intuition. I just have a hard time with that idea. Janine, and then Ricky.
It was very similar to Etty, but it's also possible, if you want to surmise that Shaul told her, you could also surmise that one of the men leaked it to her, that one of the guards knew what was happening. They loved David, and maybe they told her.
It's not
more of a leak than thinking that Shaul told her.
Well, there's a big difference. The difference is that Shaul was open with his family before, so we have reason to think that. There's no record here at all of anybody else talking to Yonatan or Michal. I can't prove you're wrong. Maybe that's how, or as Jeanette writes in the chat, maybe she overheard. She hears the guards outside the house. All of these are plausible, and the Sefer doesn't see fit to tell us. Ricky, what were you going to say?
Is there any significance to the fact that these are two sentences written as one? I know that in the Torah there is no punctuations, of course, but still, it reads very strange. Vayishlach, but again, normally there are little pauses and little. Is there any significance to that?
So it's an interesting point. I think in Shmuel you often see, and not only in Shmuel, other Sfarim in Tanakh also, that you get these long sentences that are actually compounds of shorter thoughts. Even in the next sentence, you know, she lowered David from the window, and he went, and he fled, and he escaped.
Follow.
I mean, those follow closer, it's true. But I just think I don't know that I'd be too much into it. The only thing I would note is that putting them together conveys a sense of immediacy. You know? This happened, and then this happened. She saw the guards, and she knew. You know? That kind of thing, which supports the intuition read as opposed to the overhearing or somebody telling her read, but you can't really prove one way or the other. Yes, Claudette, and then we're going to go forward.
If we go back to chapter 18, you can see that Saul's plan was to have Michal marry David to snare him. So he did not think that Michal would go against him. So maybe he did give her the information because he thought he had an ally.
Right. So we talked a little bit at the time about what he means by marrying Michal in order to snare him, whether that meant the Philistines were more likely to attack him or some other explanation. But yeah, I think that you're right. I think he sees Michal as an ally. So one other note here. In terms of these agents who we now decided are not there in order to kill David, they're only watching. So what exactly does that mean for their mission? The simple read is what Metzudat David says in source number 3. Lishomro, to watch him, Leval Yivrach Balaila, lest he flee at night, to bring him to him in the morning, to stand before Shaul like before. This is a little bit different from Ralbag's presentation, but fundamentally, what he wants is to make sure David's coming back to the palace in the morning, and he'll have another chance to kill him. That's the way that Metzudat David reads it. It's consistent with Ralbag. However, the Malbim gets way more, what's the word? Machiavellian, maybe, but not really Machiavellian. It's the wrong word. But there's a much more, intriguing plot going on here, according to Malbim. Malbim believes that Shaul's plan is to label David a rebel against the throne, what's called in Hebrew, Moreid b'malchut, in order to justify an execution. In other words, this isn't going to be a secret thing. This isn't going to be, I'm just going to throw the spear and, oh, happened to kill David. This isn't going to be David disappearing under cover of night. This is going to be a public execution of a rebel against the throne. Where does Malbim see that? He's ingenious. Take a look at source number 4. I'm going to read it through just in my English translation here, just because there's a lot of text. He found a claim against him, against David, to judge him as a rebel against the throne for leaving without his permission. You are serving the king. You walk out on the job. The king has not dismissed you. That makes you a rebel against the throne. As a cover to justify killing him, Shaul first sent agents to watch him. This was a great tactic. For if he were to kill David immediately, people would say he killed him without due process. There should be a trial. If he would not send people to watch him, but only bring him in the morning, then people would say, look, he didn't flee. He stayed home. He didn't flee at night. He's not a rebel. If he were a rebel, he would have fled already during the night. So he sends people to guard David so that he'll be able to say, the only reason David didn't flee during the night was because I sent guards to watch him. Otherwise, David was out of town. And he also thought that perhaps David would fight with the guards, would stand against the guards, then his blood would be on his own head. In other words, Shaul is thinking this is a win-win. I'm going to send guards, and that will be a way to show people that David is actually wanted to flee, but he couldn't. And maybe he'll get into a fight with the guards, and that will be even better. That's the way that Malbim reads this. And he says, not only that, in source number 5, the mission of the first group, right, the first set of Malachim, was only to guard him. And he also thought if they would desire to take him, if they would desire to take David, he would stand against them. And so he would become, again, legally liable for death for fighting the king's soldiers. We're going to see this play out in the story. Malbim understands that this is not about some kind of subterfuge to get to kill him on the side and nobody will know. This is actually an attempt to brand David as a rebel against the throne. Really remarkable, remarkable read. Yes, Susan.
In his promise to Yonatan that he wouldn't kill David, that's also got to be on his head. So if he's expecting Yonatan to take over for him eventually, then he doesn't want his son mad at him and saying, how could you do this and all of that and have a fight with his own son? I think part of it was to find an excuse so he could do it. Maintain the throne without family.
It's a reasonable read.
He gave his word.
I think that's a reasonable read. One of the questions which is really unresolved here is this still the influence of Ruach Ra'ah, or is Shaul acting under his own logical powers at this point? Meaning, after he made the promise of I'm not going to kill him, and then he turned around and threw his spear at David, the text actually said that was Ruach Ra'ah acting. Here it doesn't say, and the commentators are not sure. So if you're going to read it as Ruach Ra'ah, then he isn't thinking about Yehonatan at all. He's just doing. However, if this is not under the influence of Ruach Ra'ah, then maybe he needs to go through what Malbim is describing here in order to justify himself before Yehonatan. I hear the idea.
But also, when it's not just Yehonatan, it's also the people, but if there is no Ruach Ra'ah, like, we're saying if there is a Ruach Ra'ah that's causing this, then what we're saying is God is purposely setting up a war.
No. What's
the Ruach Ra'ah? It's not God.
I go back to what we said the first time Ruach Ra'ah showed up in chapter 16. Ruach Ra'ah is Shaul's reaction to the absence of that closeness to God that he had had before. That's what it is. Now, what you said at the end there, right before I cut you off, was a bigger point, which is, doesn't God know that this is what he's creating? We have to come back to that at the end of the chapter when Shmuel gets involved. Because one of the big questions that frustrates me as I read this story is, where in the world is Shmuel? He's supposed to be the adult in the room. So we need to come back to that. We're not going to get to that this week. But
didn't we say about Shmuel in when he left how defeated he was, and he sort of like washed his hands, we had said, way back when he left and had to anoint David? He was just mad, we got the feeling, and I'm walking out of this.
So mad wasn't the term that I would have used. I mean, he felt more broken than mad.
Okay, but we saw he sort of said, okay, you're anointed, I'm leaving you, I'm not instructing you.
Well, we have a phrase in Hebrew, Daya Letzara Beshata. It's enough to deal with one problem at a time, okay? We'll deal with Shmuel when we get to Shmuel. Right now, let's deal with Michal. Yes, Janine.
I just wanted to say I find it fascinating that the tactics that are used are the two tactics that David used later on in the case of Bathsheba, both putting him in danger and then saying he was worried that he was rebelling against the king.
Yes.
And therefore deserving death.
Yes. This will show up again. you are correct. I don't know what to do with it, but you're correct. So Michal says, I'm letting David out the window. Her decision to help David is something I want to come back to. I'm not ready yet. We have to finish the story first, and then we can come back to her decision to support David here. But she says, let me let him out the window. Ralbag says, this is more than just a stall tactic. She's hoping that this will enable David to survive the assault from Shaul, and they can move on. Take a look at source number 6 at Ralbag. And again, because it's a lot of text, I'm just going to read my English translation, but you have the Hebrew there. It is suitable, this is part of Ralbag's lessons, remember we've said this many times, at the end of each unit of story, Ralbag gives you lessons that you can learn from the story for your own life, for your own activities. So this is lesson 31 on a very long stretch of story. He only puts his lessons in at the end of the first chapter in Shmuel Bet, and it's covering a whole bunch of chapters. So he says in lesson 31, it is suitable for one who seeks to achieve a goal to not stint on any means which could lead to the completion of that goal in the most complete way. He says, you want to achieve something? Do everything you need to do to get there. Don't decide you're going to take a shortcut. Thus you will find that it did not only say that Michal lowered David from the window, that he might escape from her father by fleeing. For perhaps the king would order it, and they would pursue him and catch him. But she brought in other means. She didn't just lower him, placing the trafim in the bed, the kfirizim at his head, so that when Shaul's agents would come to her, she could say that he was ill, and they would leave him for some time. Or perhaps Shaul will be appeased by this. He's going to say, oh, David's sick, and he wouldn't try to kill David anymore. For he would see that he had not succeeded, and perhaps God would strike David. Or perhaps Shaul would regret his rage and leave him be. Either way, David would have the chance to flee and distance himself from that place such that he would not fall into Shaul's hands, and he would be saved. She's thinking broadly. It isn't just get him out of here. It's let me buy time and create an alibi which could itself convince Shaul to leave him alone. Now, she takes advantage. Yes, Jeanette.
The only problem I have with that is, if that was her goal, why did she then say that he threatened her with death? Because, like, that's not going to ingratiate him, you know, for Shaul. That just seems to create a bigger problem.
I hear. I could answer that it's because she still needs to put up a front. That's still part of this, part of this. And it also could be because at this point, Shaul has, at this stage, Shaul has shown that he's not giving up. Right? In other words, he heard that David is ill. It didn't help. So maybe that's why. Maybe it's just a shock of hearing him call David my oyev. Right? Which, you know, we've said is an active enemy. Sorry?
Is she afraid of her father?
Wouldn't you be?
I don't know. It depends how he is with his children. I don't know.
I mean, knowing the behavior he's demonstrated and the mercurial character of it and the fact that he's ready to kill David, I mean, I'd be afraid. Okay. So what are Trafim and why are they in David's house? Trafim play at least two roles in Tanakh, right? What are Trafim? You tell me.
We
think of them as idols. Why do we think of them as idols?
Rachel.
Okay. You're assuming that they're idols in that case. I want to come back to that one. Any other possibilities for what they could be in Tanakh?
Images.
Images?
Because they're like idols. Depends how you look at them.
Right. I mean, I really want to know not just what they look like, but what's their function?
To worship.
Well, that would make them idols.
Yeah.
So let's take a little trip through Tanakh here in order to see the options for what idols could be. If you take a look on your sheet in source number 7, you will see that I gave you references to different psukim, and I did it in 3 sets. So the first set takes us to Shoftim chapter 17. Chapter 17, sentence 5. Do people see that? What's the story there that we're talking about? I muted everyone because I heard a horn. Nope. Chapter 17, sentence 5. Shimshon is ended in chapter 16.
Oh, wrong chapter. Sorry. Micha.
The idol of Micha. Right? You may remember, those of you who were here when we did Shoftim, it's a while back, Micha's idol may not be an idol, right? We had a lot of confusion as to whether it's an idol or whether it's meant to worship God and it's just borrowing elements of Canaanite idol worship. But when you look at it here in sentence 5, it said Micha had a Beit Elohim, or Elohim, a house of God of some kind. Vayas ephod utrafim, and he made an ephod, which is some kind of a jacket, and trafim. It's definitely not a good thing, and it's definitely associated with worship. The ephod is its own discussion. We talked about the ephod with Gidon also. I'm not going there right now. But that's one example. Here's a clearer example. The next verse that I gave you. Malachim Bet, Kings 2, chapter 23, sentence 24. We are now in the time of King Yoshiyahu. King Yoshiyahu gets rid of idolatry. And what does it say in Kings 2, chapter 23, sentence 24? Yes, Linda.
Sorry?
Oh, you don't need to read out the text to me. Just tell me what it's saying.
Oh, the trophy. That these were all in Yehuda and Jerusalem.
But these are all things that Yoshiyahu got rid of.
He destroyed items that were used for worship or for forbidden things.
Right. Idolatries and sorceries. Right. It sounds like this puts Trafim, see, really, you could read it either way. You see, the text gives you 5 items. Okay? The text gives you 5 items in the sentence that Yoshiyahu eliminated. The first 2 that are listed are Ovot and Yidonim, which are not idolatrous in and of themselves, but they're used to try to see the future and get special messages. The 4th and 5th, Gilulim and Shikutsim, are idols. So the question is whether Trafim belong with the first 2, which are tools of sorcery, or the last 2, which are idols. The view in the Zohar on Trafim here, and other end of the spectrum, Josephus, is that these Trafim are in fact idols. That's one school of thought. However, there's another school of thought. Trafim are not idols necessarily, but rather they are oracles of some kind. So if you remember, take us closer to home. Shmuel Aleph, chapter 15, sentence 23. When Shaul has not done what Hashem told him to do in the war against Amalek. So Shmuel says to him, Ki chatat kesem meri. Meri, rebellion, is chatat kesem, like a sin of sorcery. Ve'aven utrafim haftzar. Hafetzar, the refusal to do what God told you to do, is like aven utrafim, which in the context sounds like it's sorcery. It's not about idolatry, it's about sorcery. Mind you, that's still not good. Let's be clear about that. But it's not idolatry. Better example, Yechezkel chapter 21, sentence 26. I'm just reading through the verses that are there on your sheet, so you can see all the references. You can beat me to it if you want. Chapter 21, sentence 26. Do you see that?
Yep.
Okay. The king of Babel stood at Eim Haderech, at the fork in the road, at the junction. Barosh Shnei Adrachim, at the head of the two paths. Liksom Kesem Kilkel bachitzim sha'al batrafim ra'aba kaved. He engages in sorcery. He does it with arrows. He asks of the trafim and he looks at the liver. Oracles, signs for the future. If you have something to use as a bookmark, bookmark that verse in Yechezkel, because that verse is going to matter more for us in a little bit. Zechariah chapter 10, sentence 2. One more verse. Okay, we're towards the end of Treyasar. Zechariah says, sorry.
I'm sorry, I was talking out loud. Okay.
Zechariah says, to ask God for rain, you should turn to God for rain. Ki atrafim dibru aven v'akosmim chazu sheker. Because the trafim speak corruption, or that which is empty. The kosmim, the sorcerers, envision falsehood. So these are entities that are used to make predictions. And Ramban, on the Lavan story with his trafim, uses this explanation as well. Trafim are not idols, he says, but rather they are some kind of oracle. And then you have the cases that are unclear. So Lavan is an example. Lavan calls the Trafim Elohai, my powerful beings. What does that mean? It could be either one. And I gave you a reference, I see you, Ricky. I gave you a reference to Hosea as well here. Hosea describes how we have no leaders, we have no korban, we have no matzeva, no monument, and a fod and trafim, but it's not clear what he means either. Right now what we've shown is that you have texts that describe them as idols, you have texts that describe them as oracles, and then you have texts that are unclear. Yes, Ricky.
So, if it's an oracle, then what is Michal doing with that?
So this is where we're going. We're not done yet. So, in our story, we have no indication of what they are. The only thing they are here is a fill-in for a human being. The only thing we know is that their shape must be humanoid in order to get away with this. That's all we got. If you take a look on your sheet at source number... Oh, I didn't remember bringing Ibn Ezra on the sheet. That's funny. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 8, I thought I had brought you Radak, but it's okay because Radak is quoting Ibn Ezra, so we're good. Radak says it can't possibly be an idol. That doesn't make any sense. And he quotes you Ibn Ezra's view. Ibn Ezra writes in source number 8, Yesh omrim, some say shu kli nechoshes ha'asui ladas chelkei ha'sha'os. Some say that this was a copper implement of some kind that was made in order to tell time. It was a clock. How do you like that? It was a clock. Radak doesn't like that idea here because he says, I don't know too many human-shaped clocks. I mean, that's just a failure of imagination. But okay, fine. But he goes on to say, Va'acherim amru, ki yesh koach b'chachmei ha-mazalos la'asos tzura b'sha'os yidu'os tedaber ha-tzura. Some say that there is some kind of power that those who know the constellations, astrologers in other words, are able to make a form that will speak at particular times. The evidence for this idea is that verse that we saw in Zechariah that talks about the Trafim actually speaking. So he says, Upir shapasuk einenu kein. But he says that's not what the sentence means. Vakarov elai. You know what I think it is? He says, Shatrafim hem al tsuros b'nei adam. Trafim have human shape. V'yasuya lekabel koach elyonim. It is designed to receive some kind of celestial forces, to channel them. V'lo ucha lefaresh. And I don't know how it happens, but that's what it's meant to do. V'ha'ed shatrafim kein. And he says, the evidence for this is, the fact that Michal can put them in the bed and the guards think that this is the body of David tells you that they must be of humanoid form. That's what Ibn Ezra says. Radak likes it. Ralbag likes it. It's something that is used to convey higher forces in some way. I read an article online by a fellow by the name of Dr. Alex Klein, in which he asks the question, if they have human form, how did they fit into Rachel's camel's saddlebag? Like, how in the world did you manage to hide that from Laban?
Well, she also sat on it.
Sorry?
She also sat on them.
Well, that, I mean, I don't know, you can sit on something, but how are you hiding it by doing that? So, I think the answer has to be...
A few of them. And you put them one next to the other to create a
So the answer that I would propose is that there are multiple entities called Trafim in Tanakh. And some are shaped one way, and some are shaped another way, and they don't match each other. There must be a common denominator such that we use this word for all of them. But you can't assume that what you see for Trafim in one case is necessarily the form or function in the other case. Sandy, I'm going to give you a way out idea shortly. Yeah.
Okay, so two things came to mind for me. The one is a golem that we heard, the golem of Prague, whether it was true or not. So maybe there were some kind of spiritual, Kabbalistic things they did in those days. And the other thing is, she was a daughter of a king. It's very possible that for her gowns, which would have been perhaps, maybe I'm thinking in terms of aristocracy, much more beautiful than the lay person, she might have had some kind of a bust that they put them on to take them off at night and take them down. And that could have been a more lifelike form of something, not to be confused with idol worship, because all these other examples to me really look like idol worship, but I'm just trying to...
Yeah. So it's funny. I have seen some contemporary writers suggest that there's a mannequin of some kind involved, but I want an earlier source before I'm going to use it and say that's an explanation. But I have seen that suggested, that this is some kind of a mannequin. The term in Hebrew that I've seen used is the kolev, kuf vav lamed bet, which I think
is... My translation says mannequin.
Your translation says mannequin. What translation is that? You're muted.
Sorry, it's Art Scroll. It's the Reuben edition.
Interesting. And do they tell you who they're quoting?
Sorry?
They don't tell you who they're quoting?
That's the pasuk. Michal took the mannequin and placed them in the bed.
That is really funny. Okay. Usually, I believe that they use Radak on Nach, but that's not what Radak says here, so I don't know. Okay, Ruth and then Chana.
Are these trucking, whatever they... Are they acceptable?
Well, that's what we're trying. That's what we're wrestling with. If they're idols, they're definitely not acceptable.
Not exactly, but from all these sources, they're not exactly idols.
Mm-hmm. So if they're for sorcery, they're also prohibited. Right. if there's some kind of entity like Ibn Ezra describes that are meant to channel divine forces, then they're definitely on the gray area, you know, part of the spectrum, but so not necessarily prohibited.
So exactly, in that case, what's Michal doing with it?
So that's the problem. Chana?
I think all the possibilities that you brought up came to a certain shape. And I think, since Michal loved you all so much, nowadays, if you love somebody, a lot of people have pictures in their homes from somebody
Ooh.
If the person is away. And David wasn't home alone.
So
maybe she wanted a picture of him, a three-dimensional picture.
This is very good. Channeling not celestial forces, but on Isaac Abarbanel. Chana anticipates source number 9. Look at this. Va'aniach shov. And I would never have guessed this idea at all, so I give you a lot of credit. Va'aniach shov sha'trafim bechlau hem kitzuras adam. He says, I think trafim in general are a human form. Mehem na'asim la'avodazaras. Some of them are made for idolatry. And some of them are made in order to draw down celestial influence. And some of them are clocks. And some of them are modeled on the form of a particular person, resembling the person's appearance and form. Women would have these in the image of their husband, so that they would always be able to see his appearance, because they so loved him. And that was what Michal had in the form of David. Le'ahavasa es David ma'od, because she so loved David. V'lo hayabem tzadavon, there's no sin at all in this. V'lachein sama osam bimekamo ki hayu kidmusav, and that's why she was able to use them as a substitute for David in the bed, because they actually were shaped like David. Wow. Shkayachana.
It sounds like cheating.
It's a little bizarre to me. I also wonder, because you're not allowed to create forms in the image of a human being. That is prohibited. That was what
maybe
Ricky was going to say. Right, so maybe it was malformed in some way. And that way it didn't actually, you know, fully resemble a human form. I don't know. The whole thing sounds very iffy to me, but I don't have any better answers. I mean, one thing you should keep in mind before I take your question, Susan. One thing you have to keep in mind is, we make certain assumptions when we approach texts in Tanakh, and the assumptions are not necessarily, well, a key assumption, and this assumption is not necessarily correct. We assume that we are going to understand all the references in the Pasuk. If you only learn long enough, see enough material, and think deeply enough, we're going to understand every reference and every word and every story that's there in Tanakh, and it's not necessarily true. There are cases in Tanakh where the text is referring to something that was known back then, but that we just don't know anything about. You know, you look at some of the stories that appear in Sefer Bamidbar, the references to a particular war or a particular book, Sefer Milchamot Hashem, which we don't have. And the answer sometimes is, they knew what Trafim were, and therefore it made sense that all of these, you know, different types of things could be subsumed under the title Trafim, but we're missing some information, and therefore we just don't know. The best we can do is say, well, Trafim shows up here, 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 and here. It's clearly got a humanoid form in our story, or this doesn't make any sense. And that's the limits of what we can do. It's possible to say, I don't know, and just leave it at that. Susan.
I have one yours in my commentaries. But I also have J.K., Joseph Kara?
Yes, Rav Yosef Kara.
With a different explanation.
What does he have?
Can I read it rather than my paraphrase?
Go ahead.
Their presence at David's house is somewhat puzzling. J.K. explains that this case of jeopardy
to one's life, he may consult a Tropheim to know what the future has in store for him. The details of Sans' plan were probably concealed from Michal, lest she reveal them to her husband. For this purpose, to discover her father's plan, she consulted the Tropheim. He even suggests that they were a skull which was used to foretell the future. This is directly contrary to the biblical precept in Vayikra, yeah, and is only permitted to save one's life. I explained that she found the Tropheim and pretended that it had revealed Saul's plan to David, lest Saul suspect her of revealing it. This is more likely, since according to Rambam, laws of adultery, that these types of adultery and are therefore forbidden, even to save one's life. Furthermore, it's difficult to comprehend the seemingly inconsistency that one must have implicit faith in the Almighty and must not consult for fortune tellers, astrologers, and necromancers.
Yeah, you know what, Susan, do you have a lot left? Because I'm running out of time.
Okay, then I'll stop.
Okay, so it's an interesting idea. The suggestion that she made use of them just in this particular circumstance. My problem is Iker Chaser Min HaSefer. Then the text is missing something. The text should have actually said she used the Tropheim or she pretended to be using the Tropheim and therefore they were there. Like, that's missing. It's an interesting idea. But what I want to do, we only have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to make sure to address the other thing she used. This Kavir Izim. Kavir Izib, if we had more time, I would ask you what your translations have, but we don't have the time for it, so I'm not going to. The word Kavir, Kaf Bet Yud Resh, is very unclear here. The Targum on this, as well as Rashi and Ralbag, say that it was the hide of a goat. And the idea is that there's no hair on the Tropheim, and she wants it to look like it's David. So she takes a goat hide, and that has the hair on the hide of the goat, and that's able to make it look like David's there. Those who think that David, being Admoni, had red hair, maybe the goat is a red goat, I don't know. Radak says it's a pillow made out of goat hair, which I think is interesting. But the most interesting explanation that I saw, Rav Bazak quotes this, from Josephus. Take a look at source number 10. Josephus tells the story in Antiquities of the Jews. So she let him down by a cord out of the window and saved him. And after she had done so, she fitted up a bed for him as if he were sick and put under the bedclothes a goat's liver. A goat's liver. How do you get that from the Hebrew?
Kaved.
Right? Kavir. Kaved. So the idea is kaved izim. It's a goat liver. Why a goat liver? So I've seen various very interesting explanations, but I wanted to show you one thing. You bookmarked that sentence in Yechezkel? Right? Chapter 21, sentence 26. The king of Babel is standing at the fork in the road, at the top, you know, astride the two paths. Lixom kesem, to engage in sorcery. Kilkal bachitzim, to do something corrupt with arrows. Sha'al batrafim, to ask of the trafim. Ra'ah bakaved, to see it with the liver. So there is an association here. We're going to come back to this sentence. Not yet, but in chapter 20. Because did you notice what else was in this sentence? What other item is being used for sorcery? Arrows. In chapter 20, you're going to have that story from Machar Chodesh, right? That story about David and Yehonatan and shooting the arrows into the field to indicate whether David should stay or should go. So we're going to see in one of the articles that I've been quoting, I'm going to come back to, a whole discussion about how all of this fits in a piece and fits potentially with something that's not coming until Perek Chafchet. Chapter 28. So we're gonna have to play the long game in this conversation. But what we've accomplished, hopefully today, aside from the summary that, you know, brings us a little bit up to speed, is that we've seen Shaul's instructions to his men not to kill David, but to watch him, whether in order that he should be able to bring him in the morning and kill him, or whether in order to establish that David is a rebel throne. Michal decides to save David. How she knows, very, very unclear. Why she chooses to do so, we still have to talk about, but she uses trafim, which mean different things in different places. Sometimes they're idols, sometimes they're oracles. Maybe it's a bust of David. She uses them plus something involving a goat in order to pretend that it's David there ill in the bed. And what we have to continue with next time is, first of all, the second and third sets of agents and what their missions are. And then Michal's decision to save David, why did she side with David? And I hope also next time we'll start on the third of Shaul's allies, Shmuel, and what happens when David goes to Shmuel for help. So, God willing, that will be next week. It was great to see you again. Linda, I agree with you. It's odd to think of David being comfortable having a large bust of himself in the house. That does seem a little strange. But hey, you know, maybe it was normal and therefore, I don't know. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.